When is a wedding cake more than just a cake? When it's at the center of a dispute pitting gay rights against freedom of religion and expression. I'm Kay McIntyre, and today on KPR Presents, the Masterpiece Cake Shop case, religious rights or unlawful discrimination? The U.S. Supreme Court is expected to rule shortly on the case, which started back in 2012 when Charlie Craig and David Mullins tried to order a wedding cake from the Colorado bakery. That lawsuit was the topic of the Dole Institute of Politics' annual Constitution Day Forum, held on September 19, 2017. This event featured Robin Fretwell Wilson, who teaches law at the University of Illinois, Camilla Taylor, senior counsel for Lambda Legal, and was moderated by Steve McAllister of the University of Kansas Law School. He now serves as the U.S. Attorney for Kansas. Today's KPR Presents was originally broadcast on December 3rd, 2017.
We actually picked this topic a year ago when I tried to get these two experts together for Constitution Day last year, and we couldn't make it work on the dates. So we said, well, let's just do something we've never done before and actually plan way ahead. And so we had them committed last September for this program. On a topic that seemed timely last September, but if anything, even more timely now. And so my limited role here to get this started, I'm going to talk for just a minute about a pending Supreme Court case that kind of sets up some of the issues, not all of them, but some of them that may be discussed tonight. And that's the Masterpiece Cake Shop case that the court granted review in this summer after holding it for many months, perhaps waiting until they got nine justices so they were confident they could decide the case. We'll see. But it's a case that's very interesting, comes out of Colorado, and a man named Jack Phillips, who's a baker and considers himself quite an artistic baker, and if you look at pictures of his cakes, they're quite nice, quite elaborate, but he bakes all kinds of things, but apparently had a same-sex couple, two men, come in and say, we'd like to order a wedding cake. Once he realized it was a wedding cake for a same-sex couple, at least as it's been reported, there really wasn't discussion. He said, I'm sorry, I just can't do that. Marriage is important in my religious beliefs, and I just, for religious reasons, I can't do it. They brought suit, or at least started proceedings that led to suit against him, arguing that under Colorado's anti-discrimination law, which would be common sort of thing in many states and local jurisdictions, but says no discrimination in public accommodations basically on various bases, but including sexual orientation. And so it went to a Colorado agency, which said, yes, he's violating the law. His religious objections do not allow him to be exempt from the law. Went into the Colorado court system, was affirmed there. So as the case comes to the Supreme Court, he has raised an objection, both religious and free speech, but the Colorado law is an anti-discrimination law that was not targeting religious people or bakers. It's just a very general law trying to treat people equally. So the questions in the Supreme Court are things like, well, do his religious beliefs give him some constitutional way out of this, some exemption? And the other issue is he says the cakes themselves are very artistic, so they're a form of expression, so they're speech, and you're basically trying to compel him to engage in speech he doesn't want to engage in. So he actually has a religion claim and a speech claim, and we may get in somewhat to the merits of those potential claims. But that's kind of a backdrop, and that case is being briefed right now and then will be decided by next June, presumably. So that's in front of the court, a real concrete example of the kinds of issues we're talking about tonight. But I've asked our two experts, that's it for me, I've asked our two experts to give some opening remarks to kind of set the stage, set the background, and there's a fair amount of territory. So Masterpiece Cake Shop is just one example of many potential situations. Robin?
I think in many ways in the last couple of years since the landmark same-sex marriage decision in Obergefell, we focused a lot on tensions, a whole lot on collisions, including Masterpiece, less on solutions. And I want to suggest that there may be solutions to some of these collisions, but I need to go backwards to Obergefell and set the stage for just a moment. And this sets the stage to some extent for the wedding cases and other collisions. Now, Obergefell was a huge victory, in significant part because of the work that Camilla and others have done for years in the court. And people locked out of marriage were rightly elated to have the protections of marriage that many of us take for granted. But that decision, celebrated by so many, was feared and the source of concern to many others, not the least of which were the four dissenting justices, including Chief Justice Roberts. You might remember that Roberts read his dissent from the bench, the first time he's done that at that time in a decade of service on the Supreme Court. And he was worried about what would happen to people of faith when their views became disfavored and sort of out of step with the rest of the world. What would happen, he says, to religious adoption social services agencies? What would happen to the 1,014 religious colleges, many of whom have married student housing? Could they limit married housing to students, for example, in marriages whose that they recognize as a matter of faith, or would they, in effect, be forced to close? What would happen, although he doesn't discuss this so directly, to the baker, the photographer, the candlestick maker? Now, these are legitimate concerns, but not because of same-sex marriage qua marriage, but because of the structure of non-discrimination laws, I will argue, that were passed long before marriage came on the scene, laws that were written without marriage in mind, and so are not responsive to the unique concerns that marriage raises as a religiously infused service. Now, the majority, written by Kennedy, gives really just almost this much attention to the question in a few short sentences. And he cites First Amendment free exercise guarantees. People, he says, can continue to teach and preach what they believe. And he goes on to say, for people of faith, well, he says, you can basically just be who you were before by teaching and preaching what you believe. Now, for people of faith, living out their faith means carrying it with them in the world. It means not just the ability to worship in your home in private, or even to speak openly. It means to act consistently with your faith. So I think in some ways he gives short shrift to these concerns. Now, legislators in some sense didn't have a chance to address the question in much of the country because lower court decisions swept the nation even before Obergefell resolved it dispositively. In fact, the country went from mostly red, meaning no same-sex marriage, just a few months before Obergefell, to blue in a matter of months, and then blue overnight, completely blue, with the Obergefell decision. Now, courts are really good at grappling with questions directly in front of them, namely the question, can same-sex married, same-sex couples, in fact, marry? But they cannot do the hard work of balancing all the other plural interests that are implicated by that question. That's the province of legislators. It's the province of statesmen like Bob Dole, who are charged with balancing multiple interests of many, many people in a very diverse American society. Now, because it's Constitution Day, it's worth actually revisiting exactly why free exercise guarantees under the First Amendment do not protect people of faith as they navigate the world and its many laws. So do we have any law students here? Some law students?
They won't admit it, but we do. I see them.
You know where they are, okay. So the law students are gonna know the reason that people of faith are not so protected as many might assume is because of the Smith decision, which you'll remember as the peyote decision, right? And in that case, there's a set of American Indians who ingested peyote, which was a crime in that state, and they get fired from their jobs. They argue that the First Amendment meant that the law could not burden their religious practice. Everybody agreed that it was sincere, by the way, and that those laws should be subjected to heightened scrutiny. In other words, the government would need exceedingly compelling reasons, good reasons for burdening them, a compelling interest, and no less restrictive means. Now, in a decision authored by the late Justice Antonin Scalia, the court, very divided, 5-4, said no. They said that a heightened scrutiny would make every professed religion a law unto themselves. In other words, everybody could pick and choose, if they were religious, what law to comply with. But then Scalia says something that's often forgotten. He reminded people that if they're worried about this outcome, they can seek special solicitude for religious belief in legislatures, right? Just as we protect, let's say, First Amendment speech rights, of which we are very fond and protective in the United States by statute and Constitution, he says, go to the State House and seek those protections. In fact, you'll remember that that's exactly what happened. That's precisely what gave us the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, the statute that was at the heart of the Hobby Lobby decision, which later became so controversial, but at the time passed, you know, the Congress with wide bipartisan support, sponsored by Senator Hatch and Senator Kennedy. Very bipartisan measure, signed into law by Bill Clinton. It also has lookalikes in the states, including Kansas, which has a Religious Freedom Restoration Act. Now, I should pause and say that RFRAs do good work. So a few years ago, some of you might remember that Kentucky tossed 10 Amish men in jail because they were driving buggies and they didn't want orange safety triangles at the back. They would do a lantern inside, they'd do a gray triangle for safety, but they couldn't do orange because orange is flashy in their religious tradition. And so Kentucky authorities passed him in jail, tossed him in jail. Later, the legislature passes a Religious Freedom Restoration Act precisely to test these kinds of burdens on religious practice. Are they, in fact, needed? And subject them to heightened scrutiny. Now, RFRA will not get wedding vendors like Jack Phillips out of their present bind, or religious adoption agencies, potentially, or colleges that have married student housing and are religious. Because once a state passes a non-discrimination law based on sexual orientation or gender identity, SOGI, a SOGI non-discrimination law, and that law makes no special allowance for those specific religious practices, then the government likely meets the compelling interest prong under RFRA, and there's no obviously less restrictive means than saying everybody is going to comply with this law, that there will be no discrimination as to this thing in this particular context. So we've seen, with a single exception in 24 years, not a single RFRA has successfully been asserted against a non-discrimination statute, and the one case out of Michigan with a funeral home is presently on appeal. So that remains an open question. RFRA is not going to do this work. You have to go to legislatures and ask them to find a way forward. Now, what have we seen? We've seen crushing fines, like the one paid even before the Phillips case, which is presently before the Supreme Court, the one paid by Melissa Klein of Sweet Cakes under a state non-discrimination law. She also said, I can't do a cake for a particular same-sex marriage couple, and then faced a $135,000 fine. Jack Phillips, Steve has told us, is already before the U.S. Supreme Court on free exercise grounds. Query how much ground and traction he's going to get on that with the Smith decision, which I just recapped for you. If this is not targeting religious bakers, likelihood is there's not going to be a free exercise claim, but who knows. And then freedom of expression as well. Who knows how that will go. Now, let me be clear. I think these kinds of refusals are humiliating to gay couples. I think they're actually unnecessary. And what I'm arguing is that a person's religious rights should not mean that they get to say no at all costs. The project is to find ways for people to peacefully coexist and that will respect the interests of both communities and treat all people with dignity. That's going to be a hard project. But I think that should be the goal. Now, those crushing fines and cease and desist orders have all resulted because of laws that were passed without marriage in mind. And they've been applied to a religiously infused service, like asking to step off from a marriage and treating that request to step off from a marriage as if it's this guy in Tennessee who, after Obergefell, posts very proudly a no gays allowed sign. Now, I think we should not treat those two cases the same. Some would say that asking not to do the cake and telling gays to get the hell out of your store are morally equivalent and that both should be illegal. But I don't think that they're morally the same. When the Tennessee store owner says, get out, his refusal by its very nature is about the people in front of him. It cannot be parsed from those people. But when Baronel Stutzman or Jack Phillips or someone else says, please don't ask me to do this particular cake, as Baronel is shown here. She served her client, Rob Ingersoll, for nearly a decade. She made flowers for his person, Kurt, before they were actually married. She's patently not anti-gay. Instead, she was trying to honor her relationship to God and God's understanding of marriage as she understood it. And that is separable from the people in front of her. In fact, I think the refusal is less about the people in front of her than it is about God and her relationship to God. But the Colorado court found otherwise, a Masterpiece Cake Shop. Specifically, it found that only gays can engage in a same-sex marriage, so when you say no, it must be sexual orientation discrimination by its very nature. Now, I believe that the court was forced to that conclusion because they were deciding this under a law that was passed before marriage was actually conceived of in that particular state. So they could not make any special provision for marriage because they weren't writing these laws with marriage in mind. And that is true of every single one of the wedding vendor cakes, cake in photography and other cases in this country. In fact, the fact that these older laws leave no room for people of faith, though, has been used by people increasingly in the last few months in particular to resist SOGI laws for all people in the United States. So this is a letter. It basically contends that SOGI laws by their very nature will inherently hurt religion. In other words, protecting gay people means that religious people will lose. And this letter is signed by 75 religious leaders. Now, in part, that letter was responding to an equally extreme claim on the other side, which was brought, sort of surfaced with a new report published by the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights. The report wasn't nearly as extreme as what the commissioner of the U.S. Civil Rights Commission had to say about it. And he contends on the release of the report that every claim for a religious exemption is just code for discrimination. Every claim for religious protection is bigotry, he says. Now, I think that is also wrong. What I think is important is that if we continue on this all or nothing glide path, that we are going to have a public square that's going to be different in some places than it is in others. Right now, you can think of the public square in most of the United States. You can get married in every place in the United States, but in all those places in white, you cannot be assured of having your wedding reception at your favorite restaurant. You cannot be assured of being able to go to a hotel or a restaurant or get a taxi. Now, I think that's also wrong, but you can think of the fight over Masterpiece and the fight at the polls as one over the public square. It's as if the LGBT community occupies the public square and the religious people can get out. And all the rest of the map, i.e. 33 states in America, it's as if all the religious people occupy the public square and the LGBT people can get out. So I think we have to break the tautology of all or nothing. And that's what's happened with many of these cases. Now, if we're going to do that, it's important to remember that all of those white places are, in fact, Republican-controlled, either in one chamber of the House or both chambers, and led by Republican governors in almost every single state, with an exception of two. It's also important to remember you have deeply religious people in that population. So we might expect public accommodations laws to be more responsive in these red states because they're religious, to religious values than they would have been elsewhere. And by the way, that map has been true since 2007. We have not had a single new non-discrimination law protecting the full LGBT community since 2007. And I think that's explained by two different impasses. Baker's, which we've been talking about, like i.e. finding some way for those folks to coexist with the LGBT community, and bathrooms. I wasn't going to talk about bathrooms. I'm going to spend just a minute on it. How many people saw this morning's Lawrence paper? It was a sit-in at LHS High School about how trans students are being treated in that high school. Most of it appeared to be speech. There were a few cases of it looked like potentially abuse or assault. I don't know the merits of it, and I'm not claiming to. But what I do think is important is we have seen, it seemed out of nowhere, a rise of bathroom of your birth bills predicated on the claim that this is necessary to protect people from trans folks going into bathrooms. The very last LGBT, full LGBT sexual orientation, gender identity, non-discrimination law that we had in America maps to that narrative. In fact, that narrative was put into place right after Colorado's governor signed that last law into practice. And you can see that narrative taken off. It explains the Houston Hero Bill, right, which tanked to the surprise of many people. North Carolina, to my chagrin, because I have a home in North Carolina, actually passed a bathroom of your birth law that ended up having $3.65 billion in implications for the state, real losses for that state, with, I argue in a new paper, no safety gains whatsoever. The name of the paper is called The Nonsense About Bathrooms. You could probably figure out how I come out. But North Carolina ultimately repealed that law. But the fact that they repealed that law did not stop legislators from all over the country, including Texas, from passing or proposing nearly identical bills. So it's a very, very powerful narrative. I think it's one that you can think of as saying, we can't share the public square in this regard either. I think where we land is that fork in the road. We have a choice right now to do nothing, which means that there'll be SOGI protections in much of the country that will come at the cost of some religious bakers if we try to treat them like people saying, get out of my hardware store. And in the rest of the country, we won't have any protections for the full LGBT community. And basic things that all of us take for granted. And it's because we've made a foundational mistake that we cannot share the public square, and that's just wrong.
That's Robin Fretwell Wilson, who teaches law at the University of Illinois, speaking at the 2017 Constitution Day Forum at KU's Dole Institute of Politics. This year's topic, Masterpiece Cake Shop, Religious Rights or Unlawful Discrimination. Camilla Taylor is Senior Counsel for Lambda Legal.
First of all, I'm so grateful to be here, and I'm very thankful to be invited. And it's a real pleasure also to be sharing the stage with Robin, who's a very well-renowned scholar on religious liberty. So it's an honor. Robin, I think, did a pretty fair summary from my perspective of the major court cases that are so integral to our work, and also of Obergefell versus Hodges, the sweeping victory that brought the fundamental right to marry to so many places in the country where same-sex couples were still forbidden by state law from doing so. One of the things that I think Robin and I differ on is the extent to which we are retreading old ground. And the non-discrimination laws that are at issue here are laws that were in place in some form or another for generations. We have had non-discrimination laws that prohibit discrimination based on race and sex and disability and all sorts of other protected classes for many years. And in fact, courts have resolved what happens when people claim, I'm a business owner and my religious liberty or my free speech rights are being trampled upon by this discrimination claim. You should not be able to enforce that non-discrimination law against me because that violates my First Amendment rights. That's an argument we've heard before. We heard it in 1968 in the case Newman versus Piggy Park, where a barbecue restaurant claimed that it was a matter of religious belief that they should not have to serve customers of color. And the Supreme Court rejected that argument and found they upheld the non-discrimination statute. We've seen it in the context of a case involving a partnership, a law firm partnership, that argued that it was a matter of their First Amendment freedom of association that a woman should not be able to bring a Title VII claim for discrimination based on sex when she was denied partnership. And again, the Supreme Court struck that down and upheld the non-discrimination requirement. We've seen it in the context of private schools claiming that they should have the right to exclude students of color. And the Supreme Court said, no, you have a right to express your views on segregation, but that doesn't mean that you can get exempted from having to abide by a non-discrimination law. And we have also seen non-discrimination laws upheld before with respect to marriage rights. And it's in a little bit of a different context, but we've seen, for example, state non-discrimination laws enforced with respect to landlords being required to rent to unmarried couples, even though the landlord may have claimed that it was contrary to the religious beliefs of the landlord to do so. We've seen discrimination, the case Loving versus Virginia, of course, was a case where the judge expressed the view in denying the claim for the fundamental right to marry of an interracial couple by justifying that marriage ban in Virginia in 1967. Actually, the trial judge was ruling earlier than that, but the Supreme Court ruled in 1967 that this interracial couple had the fundamental right to marry. And the trial judge had said that it was a matter of religion that God had placed the different races on different continents so that they could not marry. So we have seen religious beliefs asserted to justify discrimination before, and the courts have resolved these issues in a very consistent way across generations. Since same-sex couples have been allowed to marry, there has been a new cry, including from people of goodwill who really wish to find a compromise solution, for legislatures to do something different and for courts to do something different from what they have done before when they have been posed these questions. I would like to challenge us to examine why we should treat same-sex couples or their right to marry differently from the way that we have resolved these previous cases. Is it because we are looking at marriage rights, as Robin suggested? Is there something inherently different about marriage that should require exemptions to be carved out of the non-discrimination laws that have served us so well for so many years? And if so, why? Is it because the beliefs that concern marriage are more important than other religious beliefs? Is it because perhaps we think that there are more religious objectors with respect to marriage that's specific to same-sex couples? Is it because it's same-sex couples doing the marrying? And that there's something different about gay people that should require a different solution? What is it about gay people marrying that causes us to re-examine these precedents that have stood the test of time so well? With respect to that, I think we can find some answers from recent Supreme Court cases. I mean, Loving versus Virginia, of course, was a case saying the fundamental right to marry is universal. The fact that it arises here in the context of a different race couple, a mixed race couple, does not make it any different from any other person's right to marry. Obergefell also talked about the universal right to marry, that it was fundamental for all of us, whether we are marrying someone of the same sex or of a different sex. And if legislation begins to privilege certain religious beliefs about marriage and grant religious exemptions because it involves a marriage, then that implicates certain fundamental Establishment Clause principles as well as equal protection principles, because the Establishment Clause includes an equality guarantee within it as well. It forbids government from endorsing certain religious beliefs over others or from saying that some religious beliefs are more important than others. And so if you create a statute, as the state of Mississippi recently did, saying, well, businesses don't have to follow non-discrimination laws if they are refusing to do so because of the fact that it's a same-sex couple that wishes to marry that's implicated. If it's about marriage, then they get an exemption. We challenged that on Establishment Clause grounds. That case, unfortunately, was rejected on standing grounds, so it's up before the Fifth Circuit. We've asked for a review of that by the the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, for those who are not lawyers. But whether or not we have standing in this case, we are likely to have standing if that law goes into effect the next time someone experiences discrimination. And the Establishment Clause principles there are also fleshed out to a certain degree in some of the Muslim ban litigation. We just submitted a Supreme Court brief on that as well. But the other principle that's implicated is equal protection. Because if Obergefell happens and then a state legislature passes a bill that exempts those businesses that wish not to follow non-discrimination laws solely with respect to marriage, it's pretty clear from context that this is about allowing people not to follow the law because they do not wish to serve same-sex couples. And while we can quibble about the exact facts, and so on, Masterpiece Cake Shop is a case in which the baker was not asked to write congratulations to the loving same-sex couple on the top, or the couple didn't even get as far in the conversation as to say, can you put two male cake toppers on it for us? There, the baker simply refused to provide a baked good. What it was going to look like had not yet even been discussed, but the fact that it was going to be for a same-sex couple getting married was enough. And when that happens, then marriage is being used as a proxy for the fact that this is a same-sex couple, that they are gay. It is very difficult to say that this does not constitute discrimination based on sexual orientation. And there are a number of Supreme Court cases that have fleshed that out a bit. If you think marriage is truly different, and you would say that a different sex, an interracial couple approached the same baker and asked for cake toppers that were a black man and a white woman, And the baker said, no, I'm sorry, my religious beliefs forbid it, I can't serve you. And do you think that that would be equally valid and equally worthy of an exemption? You have a certain consistency of belief there, but I think that fails to recognize the harm caused by discrimination, including by discrimination on the part of small businesses, which are about 50% of the economy. There is also no limiting principle to saying that there should be such an exemption, because if a cake baker has the ability to exempt itself from non-discrimination laws by saying it's very expressive, well, what about the hotel that commonly puts a sign up when someone is getting married, congratulations, Melissa and Doug, and now is required to say, congratulations, Sam and Doug. Is that not expressive? Where do we stop? What about the carpenter who builds beds, who now refuses to sell to unmarried couples? Or there are all sorts of different ways that you can think that this exemption would swallow the rule of the non-discrimination law. I think we are in both an exhilarating time and a dangerous time. We have seen millions of micro acts of bravery on the part of young people especially, but also LGBT people of all ages, all across the nation coming out courageously, feeling pride and trying to attain some sort of security, trying to live their dreams of having a family. And that has propelled changes in public opinion that, you know, even those of us in the movement perhaps couldn't have anticipated. We've gone from when I filed my first marriage lawsuit, there was perhaps 40% public support measured nationwide. Now we have majority public support. And LGBT people are not going back into the closet. This community is here to stay. And because this still seems so fresh and so new, I think it is very tempting, particularly for people of goodwill who really wish to make some sort of accommodation, to try to find some new solution for this new group of people stepping forward for the first time whose claims for equal dignity and humanity have never been recognized before. And I hope that we can instead learn from our past and realize the extent to which what we are being asked to do here is truly to recognize equal dignity and truly to respect the individuals who are asking for equal treatment. And one of the quotes that I think was most meaningful to me from the Supreme Court was in Lawrence versus Texas, where Justice Kennedy acknowledged the degree to which we can all evolve in our understanding of other people and their equal rights to dignity. And he said something that I'm going to paraphrase and maybe massacre a little bit. But he said, times can blind us to certain truths, and later generations can see that laws once thought necessary and proper, in fact, serve only to oppress.
That's Camilla Taylor, Senior Counsel for Lambda Legal, speaking at the Constitution Day Forum at KU's Dole Institute of Politics. Before that, we heard Robin Fretwell Wilson, who teaches law at the University of Illinois. Today on KPR Presents, Masterpiece Cake Shop, Religious Rights or Unlawful Discrimination? The U.S. Supreme Court is expected to hand down its decision in the case by the end of this month. You're listening to KPR Presents on Kansas Public Radio. Today on KPR Presents, Masterpiece Cake Shop, Religious Rights or Unlawful Discrimination? I'm Kay McIntyre. The U.S. Supreme Court is expected to rule shortly in the case, which was the subject of this year's Constitution Day Forum at the Dole Institute of Politics. This event was moderated by Steve McAllister, currently serving as the U.S. Attorney for Kansas, and featured Camilla Taylor of Lambda Legal and Robin Fretwell Wilson of the University of Illinois.
You know, we've never treated sex discrimination the way we treat race discrimination in America. It's just not true. So women, if I'm not paid the same amount as the male faculty on my faculty, for example, you know, my claim gets intermediate scrutiny, not strict scrutiny. And disability claims are protected very differently in the law. Employers aren't told, no, you have to hire every handicapped person who presents. They're told that they have to do certain things, but up to a point. You know, they have to reasonably accommodate folks, but, you know, not when there's an undue burden in many instances. So we've never had a single uniform principle. And in the United States, because of our awful history around race, frankly, we have subjected racial discrimination to exacting scrutiny, exactly as we should. So I don't think it's quite right to say that we should do what we've done in the past because we've done different things in different areas. Now, I also believe it's a mistake to try to do one-off rules around LGBT folks. I think that's wrong. I think if you're going to protect LGBT folks in the law, you need to do it in the same way that you do racial non-discrimination and other things. I do agree with that, but I don't think it's true that we've always treated them the same. And it's interesting that, you know, I just recently went back for a new paper to Piggy Park, okay? And I agree with you about that reading. But one of the things that's important to note in Piggy Park is that Title II, which is the Federal Non-Discrimination Act, it doesn't cover, stores and retail businesses. And Piggy Park specifically said, and that's because Congress made the finding that there was no discrimination in those areas. In fact, our federal non-discrimination law is very cabined. It's common carriers. It's gas stations. It's restaurants where food is served on the premises, not takeaway, right? It's a very narrow set of things that got regulated. Now, it's true, we do regulate that and say you can't make these distinctions based on race. We don't in sex. So if we had a bar down on Main Street that didn't want to serve women, they can do that all day long under Title II. So I think we have been trying to sort out what are the right rules. Now, I think it's important to remember that I'm not arguing that people have a constitutional right to have special protection from the law when they have a religious belief at stake. What I'm arguing is that if that map is going to be blue, and that all people get protected from discrimination, including the full LGBT, underlined T, community, then we're going to have to find ways to peacefully coexist. And that may mean that we continue to do what we've done in other spheres and not write blanket rules that follow, let's say, for example, the norms that we've had in race non-discrimination. I think it's also important to say that the kinds of things that I'm talking about are never opportunities to block people from marriage or their rights. That has to be the point where that stops. But the question on the table is, where does one person's right start and where does the other stop? And if we take the strong principle that Camilla articulated, I think that would mean that there is no room for religious people in the public square, at least as wedding vendors. Now, I think the stopping point is one that is for the hard work of legislators to write. They will say it's either here or it's there or it's here or it's there. But it's not kicking it to a court to try to decide after the fact. And I think that fact alone, that it's a process point and it's not after the fact determinations, it's not a blank check. It is something that we get together and decide on as a social contract in order to provide more protections to the full LGBT community.
There is a distinction between offering services to the public in return for a fee, entering the marketplace, and other forms of exercise of your religion. So if you choose to make your money by serving the public, whether it's sandwiches and barbecue, or whether it's bakery goods, or photography, you have chosen already to abide by all sorts of regulations, whether it's wage and hour, if you hire people, whether it's the cleanliness standards of your shop. You are subject to a large number of regulations, of which non-discrimination laws are merely one. And that is part of your social contract as a business person when you decide to enter commerce. Robin made a very good point about the levels of scrutiny. So how do courts look at discrimination based on race or sex or other grounds when it's a government actor that's doing the discrimination? And I think we're seeing a little bit of change in that regard. We've seen now three circuits that have applied what's called heightened scrutiny to classifications based on sexual orientation. And we've also seen an increasing number of courts considering sex discrimination and sexual orientation discrimination as virtually synonymous. So we are seeing an increasing recognition that when you discriminate against someone because he or she is gay or lesbian, you are actually discriminating against them because A, they fail to conform to stereotypes about how men should only be with women and vice versa, or B, you're discriminating against a man because he is with another man, and were he a woman, that discrimination would not be there. So that is a form of sex discrimination. So I do think that area of the law is in flux, and courts are growing with respect to it, as they are in many other ways. With respect to the piggy park, the government regulation, we do have a lot of work to do in order to make sure that public accommodations stop discriminating based on sex. The Equality Act is a piece of legislation that needs to pass. With respect to government's regulation of certain public accommodations but not others, based on whether they're small or large businesses, there are also other constraints on government regulating such things, like the Commerce Clause. So arguably, the government wouldn't be allowed to regulate smaller businesses, and it is not a distinction that reflects, I think, a greater value placed on the speech of small businesses, as much as it is a reflection of the restraints that govern federal regulation of that nature.
Would it be better to have Kansas pass a non-discrimination provision with some sort of religious exemption? Or if there's no religious exemption, then maybe Kansas won't pass anything at all? I mean, sort of that seems to be part of the political trade-off here, and I just, your comments on that sort of circumstance, if you will.
So we have sort of published four principles that we would like to be there before we can support legislation that purports to prohibit discrimination based on sexual orientation and gender identity. And one of those principles is that it not provide religious exemptions that are LGBT specific, and that it not undo protections for other folks, so other minorities that are relying on this non-discrimination law for protection from discrimination. We do not want diminished protection for other groups to be the price that we have to pay for LGBT people. So if that means that we don't get a law simply because it includes a broader religious exemption that would be harmful for other groups across the board, then we would oppose that. We also feel very strongly that we would not support a bill that fails to include transgender people. Sometimes our opponents in legislatures try to split the community and say, well, you know, transgender people are too much trouble because of the bathroom issue that Robin mentioned, but we'll come back for you later. Well, they never do, and so we don't support that either. Now, that does mean, as Robin pointed out, that there's been some stasis in recent years with respect to passage of new non-discrimination laws on the state level. I don't think that will last forever. I think it is much more dangerous for us to undermine non-discrimination norms now, because it will be very, very hard to go back and fix that. It is much easier, I think, for us in the future to pass a non-discrimination law that is broader in its protections than it would be to fix what we do in haste in this sort of dangerous time where we're teetering on full understanding as a public of the common humanity of our brothers and sisters.
The religious exemption, the phrase that always seems to come up in legislation is sincerely held religious beliefs. And that's when I'm glad I'm not a lawyer or a judge, because I wonder how could that be defined, and then how can that definition be operationalized in regards to carving out these exemptions?
So it's a great question, Steve, and I think one of the hardest ones. Look, some folks say that was one of the prongs under the Religious Freedom Restoration Act to even trigger protection. Sometimes it's written into positive statutory exemptions. You can think of statutory exemptions as surgical. They'll say these things are exempted. I should say, and I meant to respond to one thing that Camilla said, I don't believe that it's an establishment clause violation to write specific statutory exemptions. If it were, you would have thousands of laws that actually were struck on that basis. They're not always expressly termed in religious terms. So that, for example, we have had since 1973 the Church Amendment, which was the archetypal abortion conscience clause, partly because there were hospital providers in the market that wouldn't do abortions for religious reasons, i.e. Catholic hospitals. It doesn't say you had to have a sincerely held religious belief around abortion. It just said you could have any moral conviction about abortion, even if you wanted to perform it, by the way. These are what I call equal opportunity conscience clause protections. I think that can do some of the work in this context to protect people about their speech around marriage, faith, and sexuality, whether it's pro-LGBT or pro-traditional marriage, have a level playing field for both of those. So you could write a surgical statutory exemption that doesn't kick you into this box necessarily. You say there's something special about speech on these questions, we're going to allow that to happen. But you could also, you know, determine that you're going to say only when it's a sincerely held religious belief. And I think in that instance, it gets hard for the courts to police, frankly. So that, you know, if my belief is in the Church of Steve, okay, my belief's going to be in the Church of Steve.
Not Steve.
Yeah, this Steve. So, you know, my that's going to be my belief system, and it's going to say that I'm supposed to marry my brother, okay? We don't necessarily have to get into sincerity. It's going to be hard for the state to be able to figure that out. And people generally don't want to get into the weeds about what's a sincere religious belief because of things like the Establishment Clause. So it ends up becoming what we call in law school a gimme prong. It's almost always provided, and you can just move past that. You could test sincerity in some ways that Camilla sort of hinted at. Like if it's only LGBT persons who come and you say, I can't recognize your marriage, and let's say you're a person of the Catholic faith, and you never ask anybody about their remarriage, if they, for example, don't have a properly annulled first marriage and they have a second marriage, which would be considered adulterous in that faith system, because you're picking and choosing and you're making it, in that instance, just about gay folk, then somebody might say you don't actually have a sincerely held religious belief about marriage. That gets sticky too, though, because to some extent, each individual believer, I can be Robin in the Church of Steve, but that doesn't mean I have to subscribe to every single thing that the Church of Steve says is that faith tradition, right? Just like many, many Catholics don't subscribe to views about contraceptive, right? In fact, most of the flock is not following the bishops on that one, as it turns out. And yet we don't say that they're insincere, because the barometer isn't what that faith group as a group believes, it's what that individual person believes. And that gets much harder to police. Did I miss anything?
No, I completely agree with you. We don't even bother to challenge sincerity of religious belief because, as Robin says, it's a gimme for the courts. It's a loser for us. The courts just don't do it. We can be cynical.
Yeah, right.
But it's not a line of attack.
So Professor Wilson, you talk about this, how we need to find this balance kind of between people who have like religious convictions and those who feel like they're being discriminated against based on religion. So my question is, do you think that this compromise is gonna be like half and half, like a clear-cut compromise, or do you think that one side is gonna have to kind of cave in? And if you do believe that, which side do you think would be the one to ultimately cave in?
So tell me your name. Macy. Macy, are you in law school?
No.
You should go to law school, I think, based on that question. Look, this is really hard, because I think if you're going to make that map turn blue, people are going to have to be willing to leave something on the table. Both sides. And right now, in some of the country, I'm not asking that we undo any laws, by the way, that have already been passed in other places. I'm only talking about moving forward on the map. So I'm not talking about rolling back existing protections. But in the new parts, the parts of the country that are yet touched, Macy, you know, you can think of it as a zero for the LGBT community. Now, we might make different predictive judgments about when people, I can't quite see you, but I think of your generation. Are you a millennial?
Yeah.
Okay. So it turns out the folks who are not down with LGBT rights and same-sex marriage are dying. They're in the process. The oldest generation are slowly dying. You're becoming voters, and over time this whole thing is going to go away. And I have a piece empirically talking about that if you want to look at it. Question is how soon, right? How soon will that eventually go there? So right now, it seems to me the LGBT community, given the demographics of that map, are looking at a zero. If you say you are able to go to every restaurant, every bar, it's a bar, by the way, right? Where's the religious convictions in saying to somebody, don't go to a bar, you can't be in my bar? You know, you know, some of this is just like, there are obvious things we ought to be doing for this community. Why not leave the cake behind? If that gives you 95 out of 100, 95 is clearly better than zero. And for the religious folks, I think the opposite is true. They cannot hold on to the public square. The idea that they're going to be able to exclude folks based on some irrelevant characteristic and say to them, even as people of faith, you should not have a place to live. I mean, many people that I know of faith believe that every person has dignity. They need to have a place to live, a place to a way to make a living, and they need to be treated in the public square as everybody else. But they would hold back marriage because marriage, for 51% of Americans, is still a sacrament. It is a religiously infused service that's different than any other. And we can talk about distinguishing that from other things that Camille has talked about. So for them, they're looking at 100 going to zero. Seems to me they would do better to hold on to this, you know, very thing that's very, very precious to them. And meanwhile, the story here is that 12 bakers, count them, 12, are keeping millions of LGBT people from having these protections in the law. So I don't know, is it 95-95, 95-90? I'm not sure, Macy, but I do know that if we find a way to share that public square, both sets of people come out better. Wouldn't you like to have an end to the culture war? How many people want an end to the culture war? Can we agree on that?
I'd prefer to win it.
Yeah, I know, and that's actually the difference between us. I just want it to end. Let's do 95.
Other questions from the audience?
Hi, I have a question about what is your proposed plan moving forward. So I come from one of those white states, and we're a state that's very driven by religious beliefs at all levels. I come from a southern state, so I don't know how Kansas is because I haven't been here long, but what are your plans in attacking those legislatures? Because I know our legislature is very driven by religious beliefs and don't look to make these changes.
Could I ask where you're from?
Louisiana.
Oh, I've been spending a lot of time in Louisiana. You'll be interested to know. What was your name?
Maggie.
Well, my plan, Maggie, is to show that religious folks that they actually do better when they protect other people. That giving is the answer to cementing in the law respect for their belief too. And one of the things that you don't see in these maps that's complicated is the fact that many places within a state, the states aren't really just red and blue or blue and white, whatever map it is we're on. In fact, municipalities have passed municipal ordinances saying you may not discriminate on the basis of sexual orientation and gender identity. I see you shaking your head. And the states that I am, Senator Adams from Utah, is a gentleman that I helped with something called the Utah Compromise. By the way, it was the last law in America to protect the full LGBT community in housing and hiring. But it did it, in Utah, where the LDS church is based, it did it by providing religious protections that they felt were important and necessary and didn't take back from that overall project. But the states that we're working in are states that have municipal SOGIs that really give very little room for religious believers. So in those states, I believe you reach a tipping point at about 35% of the state. So when 35% of the state is already living under a SOGI that's like the blue part of America and leaves no room for those religious people, even though the state is deeply religious, then you have the attention of that religious community. And you can say to them, why not just make a peace on this, right? So that's the basic approach. Try to get folks at a table.
So what's Lambda Legal's strategy for dealing with the white states? I mean, you touched on the Title VII aspect. There may be some litigation avenues, but not for everything. What's your strategy?
So as a policy matter, so yes, we are litigating in employment and in housing cases that seek to define sex in federal laws that prohibit discrimination based on sex to be inclusive of sexual orientation and gender identity, which would solve those problems to a certain extent. But public accommodations law, as we mentioned, still does not prohibit discrimination based on sex. So that's something to work on at the federal level. Meanwhile, we are also trying to pass non-discrimination laws at the municipal and county level, which is a lot easier because there are dots in states that are pretty hostile, that are receptive, and that happens to be where much of the population center is. But of course, there are still people left behind in rural areas. With respect to state legislatures, we have been very much in a defensive posture over the last couple of years because, actually not even so much anymore, over marriage. Masterpiece Cake Shop is sort of slow to get up there because the issue of the day, as Robin mentioned, is terrorizing people over this boogeyman of transgender people. And there's a lot of ignorance about who transgender people are. We are now, I would say, a decade and a half behind where we are with respect to sexual orientation in terms of educating the public about what gender identity is, the fact that all of us have a gender identity, whether we are trans or not, and that for transgender people, their gender identity is simply inconsistent with the sex that they were assigned at birth, and that these are people like any other people. The other side in this battle has demonized transgender people and created a stereotype or a caricature of trans people as predatory and as hypersexualized. All of the things that we saw with respect to gay people just, you know, a generation ago, and we saw with respect to women, where working women were stereotyped as being hussies and hypersexualized as well, simply because they defied gender stereotypes in a certain way. And we saw it, you know, many generations ago with respect to race. So this is a sort of a period where we have to fight to introduce trans people to the American public. And that is going to be a battle. We've done it before with respect to gay people. You know, we're not done there, but we've certainly seen some success in a very dramatic shift in public opinion over just 5 years. And I think we can get there, and we will see very quickly after that the demise of this sort of bathroom bill amendments and legislation and a real conversation and engagement on non-discrimination protections, which is something that is not, you know, bipartisan. People can find agreement on both sides of the aisle. We just need to get a little bit closer to public understanding.
You've just heard Camilla Taylor of Lambda Legal. Before that, Professor Robin Fretwell Wilson of the University of Illinois Law School. The two were featured at this year's Constitution Day Forum at KU's Dole Institute of Politics. The topic? The current Supreme Court case involving Masterpiece Cake Shop, religious rights, and freedom of expression. The court is expected to hand down its ruling in the case within the next few weeks. This event was moderated by Steve McAllister of the KU School of Law, now serving as the U.S. Attorney for the District of Kansas. I'm Kay McIntyre. KPR Presents is a production of Kansas Public Radio at the University of Kansas.